I have a confession to make. At the time of this interview back in February, I hadn't watched much more than a trailer for Cobra Kai. Now remember, the purpose of the everything is a primary source method isn't to be an expert on a subject, just to use the piece of pop culture as an artifact of its time period, like an archaeologist would size up a piece of pottery or something. There's no need to watch the piece of media in full to use it as a primary source. However, while talking with Adam of the Raised on Film podcast about the show, a sequel series to the Karate Kid movies of the 1980s, I couldn't keep away. My family and I binged the series soon afterwards and loved every minute of Cobra Kai. When a story like The Karate Kid is revisited years later, it can reveal just as much about the society and times that brought it back as how things were when the original came out. The first film is perfect for the Reagan era. Just like Revenge of the Nerds, which came out the same year, 1984, Ronald Reagan would be re-elected in a landslide in November, The Karate Kid is an underdog story, revealing to the audience what it's like for the youth who didn't exactly fit the mold to be featured in a It's Morning Again in America campaign ad. The bad guys in both movies, Stan Gable for the nerds and Johnny Lawrence for Daniel LaRusso, are blonde-haired alpha males. The rival fraternity in Revenge is Alpha Beta, after all, who have their lives made in the shade until a challenger appears out of nowhere and threatens to take everything their jock maneuvering has achieved so far. Cobra Kai extends the original narrative to show us the antagonist's perspective. Johnny's 80s ways don't equal great success in the 2010s, but his outlook on life and martial arts skills offer a great antidote for the ills affecting the youth of the Tri-Valley area. He's very much an anti-hero, in line with many other characters from media of the 2010s, and something used by many to describe the President of the United States, who had just started his term when Cobra Kai came out. Not a coincidence, in my opinion. Just as the source material is perfect for the Reagan years, so too is Cobra Kai the ultimate Trump-era story. So don't be surprised if a Stan Gable-centered sequel series to Revenge of the Nerds called Alpha Beta shows up on a streaming service soon. Here's part two of my conversation with Adam about Cobra Kai.
So the next question that we tackle to try to figure out, you know, what a piece of pop culture can tell us about the time period or the society that made it is, where was it made? And Atlanta, Georgia seems to be the site of most of the filming of Cobra Kai, but it's set in California, right?
Yes, a majority of the filming is Atlanta, and they obviously go to LA for some nostalgic scenes at some old places and a handful of things here and there. But yeah, Atlanta is super popular. That's where most of the big Marvel movies are filmed. I was actually talking with my buddy who he works in the film for this, I don't know his exact job title, but the City of London. He works for the film production side of things, I guess. Anyways, he was telling me the tax credits and stuff like that. Yeah. Like, it's just a really good place to film.
But that was the way for a while with Canada. I remember back in the 90s, it was seemed like a lot of, I mean, the X-Files was doing a lot of filming up in Canada. And it seemed that the film industry, you know, that traditional Los Angeles-based film industry was not as cheap to make things in actual California as it used to be. And so other, the more unusual places to make movies started to show up. And I think Stranger Things is actually filmed in Georgia as well. And it must have something to do, like you said, with the tax incentive.
I believe so, yeah.
You know, they must break down a lot of the barriers of that as a way to attract more films and TV shows to be made there, because it must be a huge boost for the economy to have so much attention, you know, constantly, you know, having all the cast and crew of those things around and, you know, giving work to those places. Atlanta, I've yet to explore that city. I've been to the airport which is one of the big hubs in the United States anyway, especially that's where Delta is located. And that's a huge airport. It's bustling. And Atlanta itself has a pretty cool history behind it. You know, it was basically demolished during the Civil War and then rebuilt as a almost a northern city in the South. It's different from a lot of the other southern cities in that it's very Yankee in its kind of the society that has since lived there since the 1860s. So being able to pass it off as a place in California probably isn't that hard because it doesn't look, you know, remarkably southern compared to like if they had filmed it for some reason in Mobile, Alabama, it would be like, what are they doing in Alabama, you know, to make Cobra Kai? And you know, the other locations associated with it, that for a movie or TV show is anywhere that you can, you know, find it. Are there, as far as you know, any pockets of fandom for Cobra Kai outside of North America that are, you know, distinctive?
That I have an answer. Quickly, again, just to correct myself, my buddy Andrew, who I mentioned, just labeled as manager Film London. And just speaking about briefly what you're saying about filming in Canada, that's what he's going through right now, because London is a smaller city in comparison to Toronto, which gets a lot of action. Yeah. And his main role right now is trying to entice people to come film in our area.
Right.
And he's talking with different forms of government of trying to get tax incentive and trying to entice people to come and film here, because there's some great locations and there's so many things filmed in Canada that people don't even understand because we change it to, because it's set in the United States.
Right.
New York is a great example. There's a lot of filming in Toronto that is supposed to be New York, and there's a lot of locations and areas in Toronto that look like New York. It's the same thing as Vancouver. It doubles as California a lot because of the trees. So it's just always interesting why can't you just set something in Toronto or Vancouver? Why we have to like famously Friday the 13th, Jason Takes Manhattan. only like 10 minutes of the movie was filmed in Manhattan and the rest was filmed in Vancouver. But anyways, I just wanted to get his job title correct and shout out to Andrew Dodd. He also watches Cobra Kai, by the way. But back to your other question, I think the biggest thing because of Karate Kid Part 2, and I don't know the history of specifically where they filmed, and I'll pull it up here in a sec. But I think they, again, I don't know the specific, let me, you know what, before I answer, let me just pull it up. But because that film was shot on location and in the later seasons, Chosen returns, a couple of the other characters that were in Karate Kid Part 2 come back. So I think there's definitely a fan base there. And I'm going to get the location here, exactly where they go.
Okinawa, right?
That's okay. There you go. Yeah, I didn't know you knew. That's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. I was a pretty avid fan of the Karate Kid movies because I was a kid and I remember that was, you know, during the 80s, you know, fascination with Japan, you know, was like part of culture, you know, is like a lot of pop culture because Japan itself was it seemed like they were on a wave of pretty much influencing all of, you know, North American society and culture. There, you know, Japanese businesses and companies were buying up, you know, people were driving more Japanese vehicles than ever before. It was like, you know, that was the age of Japan kind of, you know, showing itself in a lot of ways. Actually, on the back of, just the other day, I was at a thrift store, as I usually am, and I found a Japanese baseball jacket, the Dragons, remember from that movie Mr. Baseball with Tom Selleck?
Yep.
It's that team. Yep. And I was like, I'm gonna scoop this up because I just think it's cool, because I love that. I love Japanese culture, you know, 20th century Japanese culture is really interesting to me because they borrow so much from the United States, and then come 1980s and 90s we are importing a lot of Japanese stuff into our country, and it's like going back and forth like that. So I guess it only makes sense that Cobra Kai would have a following on both sides of the Pacific like that. More so than,
and there's a lot of references in the movies, obviously, especially in the first one with Mr. Miyagi's backstory. And then it was a great idea. I don't love the film, but it was a great idea for the second one to go to his, you know, origin, where he's right. from, and learn about his past and his family. And I know they have a lot of like the stuff that he trains with and he uses are all cultural things from Japan. And like, I don't know a lot of the history, but I think that was great because obviously the third one comes right back to California, right back to the old formula. Yeah. And Cobra Kai does a nice thing where they incorporate some of the characters and the Japanese history into the story, which is good. And again, Daniel becomes more knowledgeable on his past because he obviously loves Mr. Miyagi, a surrogate yeah. father figure, but even Mr. Miyagi has some secrets that Daniel discovers throughout Cobra Kai. So it was nice that they incorporated that as well into it. And yeah, I mean that.
So once again, it seems like they, you know, are doing a fine job in Cobra Kai of, and I think this goes even beyond just movie and TV making, like the modern era, we have so much access and so much ability to flesh out stories and to add more detail and be more precise mm-hmm. about things and to recognize that people, because Mr. Miyagi for the longest time was like considered to be like the, you know, flawless mentor, you know, that everything he does has yep. a purpose behind it and it's, you know, well thought out, he's a wise man, yeah. you know, the pinnacle of that. But then to have maybe some skeletons in the closet or to show somebody's mm-hmm. vulnerabilities or weak side, I think that's such a technique that finds itself in print nowadays, you know, in you know, even like historic research, like there's a lot of history books written and museums devoted to saying, all right, here's what this well-known person or group of people are known for throughout history, but we're going to show you some behind the scenes stuff. And I think that's very you know, kind of telling of this it's not a post-internet age, but it's a internet age that has developed. Like we are able to, like in real time, you're doing research as we're talking and we can just call things up right yeah. away. Because as you said, you don't want to be, you know, you don't want to be wrong because, you know, there's no,
I don't want to be canceled. I don't right. want to screw over your podcast.
Right. Or, you know, I'll lose the 12 listeners that I have, you know, it'll be a horrible thing. But yeah, that's, you know, I think that carefulness might come from that direction of like, we don't want to be canceled. But at the same time, we live in a time with so much access to information, the Google age, that we shouldn't have an excuse to mess things up if we can make sure that we have things right mm-hmm. right away. And I think that that's showing itself throughout all sorts of media. It's not just you know, it's across the board, and it's very telling of the time period. So, and that kind of brings us to the next topic, is the intended audience. You were mentioning before the power of nostalgia, and I yeah. think that those of us who are adults nowadays, who grew up 90s early 2000s, we're victims of nostalgia just like anybody else. You know, I remember my parents, when I was growing up, they would hear a song come on the radio from their youth and they would turn it up, and you know, it would usually bring back some kind of memory, good or bad, usually good ones. But we are, those of us who are born anywhere between the late 70s and the 90s,
millennials,
we just have so much to choose from. We have so much nostalgia to work with. So we're
I have a theory. I have a okay, theory too. Yeah. Someone else is probably, this isn't mine, but I think because we had an opportunity to touch the old, and I'm talking pre-cell phone, pre-social media, mm-hmm. you know, we know what life was like before all that. And we also know what life is like with that. And we're tech savvy. We can, I mean, like if you look at most parents and like our grandparents, they don't, I know my parents don't thrive with social media. Like they struggle and it takes yeah. a while for them to learn. They eventually get it and God bless them. But, you know, just cause they're a little bit older and we can do that. I got my phone, I got the computer, we can do all this and we understand what came before. And I think with, especially with nostalgia, like you, with Star Wars is a good example. I wasn't there when Star Wars came out. I didn't see it in the theater, But when the new Star Wars movies comes out, I feel entitled to some of that nostalgia, even though I didn't see it, because I was a kid when I watched it.
Right.
And right now, like maybe a little bit of 60s, but mainly 70s and 80s is really nostalgic right now. Rocky, Karate Kid, two great examples. Star Wars as well, obviously.
And 90s is creeping in there too. There's a lot
That's what we're at right now, where the 90s are going to become the new 80s. I think the 80s are kind of at the exit a little bit. I think people are a little over the 80s. I mean, Stranger Things ran it into the ground.
Yes, it did.
I think that millennials, we're at an interesting crossroads, because we get both sides to it. But like, you have the even younger generation that literally was born with a cell phone in their hand.
Right.
They're not going to understand landlines. They're not like, it's interesting where we as millennials, like, what year were you born?
I was born early 81, so like
okay.
January of 81. So okay. I'm kind of on that. I'm on that like cusp between Gen X and millennial. I dabble. I make it seem like it's an ongoing thing, but I kind of dabble. I borrow from both ends because like I grew up in a household. I was a younger sibling, so my older brother was Gen X, you know, and I tended to look up to Gen X more than I did, you know, my own peers. Like I thought it was so cool, you know, coffee houses and computers and like, you know, that kind of stuff. I was like, yeah, you know, I like that. And not so much millennial, but the millennials are arriving now is what you're saying as far as their nostalgia.
Yeah. And just to kind of answer your question, the reason with I think millennials are a big demographic for this show specifically is because you're going to get the Karate Kid fans. I mean, anyone that's still alive that watched, no matter how old you are, 50, 60, you might check it out. But there's also a huge young dynamic to Cobra Kai as well, because like I said, the teen angst, like the CW, WB, all those old shows. Because there's teenage drama in it. I kissed this boy, and they have all their stuff going on. And I think millennials, specifically it depends on how old you are, but you can watch that stuff and still kind of enjoy it. I know a lot of people that I've talked to can't stand the young characters. They just want to follow Johnny and Daniel and Kreese and Terry Silver and all of them. So that's why I think you have, it's perfect for millennials, where you can sit and watch the new characters going through their stuff. And then you also understand the old stuff. Again, I wasn't there when Karate Kid came out. I didn't see it in the theater. I watched it some point in the 90s, and I still feel I have the nostalgia. Another good example too is like the Spider-Man No Way Home that just came out, where you have three different generations of Spider-Man, but they really weren't that far apart, but you still feel like you're a Tobey Spider-Man fan, or you're an Andrew Garfield, or you're Tom Holland. You kind of pick a side, but then you have all this nostalgia, you know, kind of just firing on all cylinders. It's insane what it does to you, and how just your reaction going to see because the first time you watch it, you're not really worrying about the story. It's just, you're waiting for those nostalgic moments, like when they appear and when they do a callback, and it does, I don't know, hormones and all that stuff. I just feel like it's triggering stuff in your body. I don't know. I'd like to do some research on nostalgia and what it does to your body, because it's weird.
It is.
I experienced it with Creed, and there's something about it.
It is, I think, a very strong, those in the media, you know, world have, a lot of them have mastered using nostalgia to their benefit, you know, some more than others, but it seems like, and actually there was some kind of, I forget. We watched Hocus Pocus 2 back in September, and we were waiting for the nostalgia factor to show up, and it never did. Because they went almost 100% brand new cast, with the exception of the witches.
Yeah.
And we were like, okay, so I don't want an old, I want a nice balance. Kind of what you were saying about, like, you know, that's where like millennials and, you know, late Gen Xers are. We have that balance of like, we know what it's like before all this high tech stuff, and we also are pretty good with it. It's that nice balance that we have. I want that balance in my storytelling too, especially my nostalgia, because I want to be able to watch a movie and not just be overloaded with fan service. Mm-hmm. But I also don't want a brand new set of characters that I need to get to know. I want something in between. I want one foot planted in the past and another foot planted in the present or even in the future. Because, you know, that one, I think, failed as a reboot because of it. It wasn't, or a sequel, because it didn't give us enough of, you know, why am I watching this? And then, you know, I mentioned A Christmas Story Christmas. They nailed it. They hit that nostalgia button perfectly, especially in the last moment of that movie. It was like when they merged the you know, kind of like Rogue One for the Star Wars, did such a fantastic job with that. By actually including, you know, people from the 1977 movie into it, and it looked pretty good. So that must be the right recipe. I think that
I got 2 points. You said a lot that I quickly, you said balance, and I think that's perfect to mention Mr. Miyagi. That's literally what he's all about. He's that's all about his MO. And his speech in The Karate Kid plays a huge part throughout all Cobra Kai, and it's a metaphor for the show about balance. It's not right versus wrong. It's a balance of both sides, Johnny, Daniel, and how they're a lot more alike than what you thought from the first movie. And I just wanted to mention that because you mentioned balance.
Wax on, wax off. I mean, it's it's everything is applied, and then it's, you know, you got to keep that nice balance throughout. And I think that must be their intended audience, is they want a balanced audience. They don't want to just go after, because if you go after just the nostalgia hounds, then
you're not going to bring in anyone else.
You're not going to have 5 seasons worth of a show.
Sorry, just on Hocus Pocus too, because I had to watch it with my wife because the original is one of her favorites. And I totally agree with you. And that's a good example of, they didn't have something to tell. They just wanted to bring the Sanderson sisters back. And they just kind of threw together a story and boom, we got them back. Was it great to see the three of them? Sure.
Yeah.
They were great. They were the best part of the movie, but the movie had really nothing else to offer them. Like, okay, they're here. It's whatever. And then the movie ends. Original's better. I might watch this again one day. I might not. I have no nostalgia for Hocus Pocus, but I'm like, compare it to like a Top Gun Maverick, where it's like, oh, Tom Cruise has a story he wants to tell. There's some callbacks and music cues and all this stuff for sure. But we have an interesting story to tell about Maverick, Rooster, Goose's son. There's something here, and they bring Iceman back for a scene. Like, they have a story they want to tell, and they sprinkle in nostalgia.
I'm curious if Top Gun Maverick has, you know, because I know they actually sat on that one for a while. They made it a couple years ago and then just released it this past summer. But I want to think for a second that I'm like, I wonder if the success of Cobra Kai had anything to do with them saying, yeah, well, let's make a Top Gun movie, because that's another one of those line of, you know, kind of, I mean, it's in the name Maverick. I mean, he's a guy, renegade, you know, he goes against the, you know, the teachings, he does his own thing. He's, you know, as Iceman says, he's dangerous. But, you know, to bring him back again, I wonder if they took a playbook from Cobra Kai and said, okay, we're going to tell something new. We have a story to tell, and it's going to be peppered with some good nostalgia stuff, but it's not going to rely on it.
Yeah.
That's a good test for a show or a movie, is like a sequel, prequel, any kind of, connection to an original, is like, could I watch this on its own and enjoy it on its own? Like, do I need the original content to really enjoy it? And if the answer is yes, you can enjoy this as its own thing, then it's made a success.
Yeah, you could watch Cobra Kai and enjoy it without having watched other movies. There's enough. I mean, just through pulp culture, everyone knows the crane kick. Yeah. Everyone knows, wax on, wax off, Mr. Miyagi. There's enough there that you could enjoy Cobra Kai on your own. If you had seen the movies before or watched them before, whatever, it just makes it better. Top Gun Maverick's a great example. You can watch it without Top Gun, but you've seen the movie before. It's just that much better. It's just enhancing the movie. It's not reliant on it.
So it's a nice supplement to the originals instead of being its own, but it could still be enjoyed. I teach economics class. So I'm trying to remember if that is a supplemental good or a complementary good that can be enjoyed on its own, but, you know, at the same time, only enhances something that already exists.
The best thing that Cobra Kai could do for an audience that hasn't seen the originals is they maybe watch the first season and like, oh, I like this. I'm going to go back. I'm talking like a 15, 20 year old maybe. And they go back and watch Karate Kid. And, oh, maybe they appreciate something that came before from the 80s. And like, damn, it might not be their cup of tea, but that's what I like about it. It's forcing people to maybe go back and look at some older stuff that they haven't seen and then finish off with Cobra Kai. I mean, that's great if they're able to do that. And it's the same thing with like a Top Gun Maverick or Star Wars or Creed or anything. It's just like, there's a lot of great stuff that you may have never even heard of. And it's hard. I mean, to live in pop culture and social media and not know who the Karate Kid and Rocky and Tom Cruise and all that stuff. I mean, it'd be really hard, but to actually go back and watch the movie, that's great. It's like, again, I mentioned Stranger Things. Kate Bush is running up the hill and the Metallica song,
Master of Puppets.
Huge jump in the charts for those songs to go back and people, you know, living through that nostalgia. And that's great for those bands and Metallica and Kate Bush, that people are going back to, and maybe they're listening to other music and buying their stuff on iTunes and stuff. Like, that's great. And that's the power of film and television and pop culture, is that you open, you're doing this one thing, Cobra Kai, but you're also opening up to so much more for people that maybe haven't seen Karate Kid. And then the people that have seen it, they have something fun to watch where it's like, oh, it feels warm. It feels like, you know, I have nostalgia for this, and now this is where they are. This is where I am. You kind of have a connection. You can connect with Johnny. You can connect with Daniel. Right. So it's nice.
And it's a modern, you know, ethics and morals tales that you get. Because I think that's something that some of the less quality reboots and nostalgia pieces do, is they try to apply values and morals from the time period of the original to the new ones, and it doesn't work that way. So Cobra Kai has connections to the original, but it's telling moralistic lessons from now. It's giving people modern, complicated, you know, conflicts to deal with, and, you know, walking them through the characters. I was just actually, my wife is a huge Little Women fan. That's like her favorite book of all time. And so she's watched all of the Little Women movies and miniseries that have been made over the years, including what they did back in 2019, when it was in 2018, 2019, right around the same time Cobra Kai came out, which was the 150th anniversary of Little Women. There was a movie made that put Little Women into the modern era. So it was like the same characters, same basic storyline of the book, but set in 2018. And then the following year, they did another feature film of it. But they told the story a little bit differently than before. Usually Little Women starts, it's very narrative, chronological, just they're little girls, then they grow up. This one started when they're adults, and they do a lot of flashback type stuff. The one made in 2019. And my wife pointed out, she's like, you know, because I'm like, the easy answer to why they keep making Little Women movies every so often is because it's like the original book for girls from American literature. Like, before that, there was never a book made for that audience before. And so as a way to reintroduce classic literature to a new generation, they keep making these movies over and over. I have to think that there's something similar, and of course each time they do, it's a reflection of the time period that they made it in, not so much 1869 when the first book came out originally. I feel like that's something similar here with what you said with this program, is like the makers of it are not just saying, all right, enjoy this on its own, but we want you to go back to the original, enjoy that. And then almost like liner notes for a CD or a record. It's like, oh, if you like this, you'll also like that. You know, if you find that you like Cobra Kai and therefore by extension Karate Kid, then start exploring that that time period in movies. You're going to find that there's a lot of underdog stories, you know, to be had, if that's something you connect with, and you can expand your, and then, you know, back to the Kate Bush and Metallica thing.
Yeah.
I know I heard Metallica actually say that they were, because there's a lot of like Metallica is one of those bands that, like, the fans are serious, you know, they don't like, they're like, you know, back in the night, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, you'd, you know, kick us out of the house for listening to Metallica. Now everybody's, but they're like, if it makes more people interested in our music, that's great. You know, like, we're not, we're not going to deny fans, because then it gets into that world of gatekeeper-ism, which is huge on the internet. Which, have you come across any gatekeepers as far as like Cobra Kai fandom? Are there people who are like, you're not a real Cobra Kai fan unless you have watched and appreciate the original movies and stuff like that?
No, I haven't come across that. I know it's out there for sure. I listen to a lot of YouTubers for sure, that have talked about their experiences, but no, I haven't experienced myself. Again, I that'd be more in the, it's unfortunate that there's people out there like that. And I mean, my thing is, who cares?
Right. I feel like this past summer, that was the big, like, if I heard Running Up That Hill one more time, you know, I was like, oh my God, like, this song, you know, was, I don't even know if it was on the radio back in the 80s, but it's on the radio now all the time, all the time. And it's like, you're people are learning about more like post-punk, you know, new wave kind of music that they wouldn't have discovered otherwise. That's great. But it's like, there's probably some hard and fast Kate Bush fans who are like, oh, I like them. And they may be secretly, one of the reasons they liked them is because they could say they liked something a little bit off the radar. They weren't into the mainstream stuff. So when something becomes mainstream, they're like, hey, you know, like, because I'm sure for the longest time, Karate Kid, after it, you know, after it was like 10 years old, 20 years old, it wasn't cool anymore to say you were into Karate Kid.
Specifically karate. Like, karate is not very karate popular at all.
People made
now
fun
it's
of
all
it.
Jiu-jitsu. Like,
exactly. When I did an episode earlier this season with my friend about UFC and how Brazilian Jiu-jitsu was basically showcased through the original UFC fight. And he was like, karate is laughable now. It's like, you know, karate was huge in the 80s because of movies like The Karate Kid and then a few other martial arts things, Ninja Turtles, you know, Power Rangers, you'd sign up and you'd join a studio to learn karate, but it's not a real fashionable, you know, cutting edge martial arts anymore. And so it's kind of funny that there's some people who may think it still is. I don't know. I remember seeing a fight one time back in like the 90s on a basketball court, and one of the kids got in a karate stance and everyone just started laughing. They're like, I don't know how this is gonna go for you, buddy. But
that's a good contrast in the show too, because you have all these young kids of this generation and they're doing karate in school. And it's like, you could just sit back and laugh. Like, what are they doing? Like, they're just like getting in their stances and they're like, there's a huge brawl in one scene. And it's like, like, this is fun. Like, again, it knows what, it's not trying to be dead serious. Like, you're just having fun with it. That's at the end of the day, this is entertainment.
Right.
And we're not making Citizen Kane. Like, you can have fun with an idea. And like, yes, does the show get ridiculous by the fifth season? For sure. Do you jump the shark? Probably at some point in season 3 or 4, I don't know the exact point, but it's fun. And at the end of the day, the characters are engaging and intriguing. And that's what, that can survive any sort of schlock,
right?
In my opinion, anyway, where I care about these characters, what's going on. I want to see Daniel and Johnny finally come together and fight a common enemy. Like, it's such a good theme for storytelling, is two people finding out that they are more alike than what they thought and joining forces to defeat the evil. Like, it's so good.
Always love joining forces stories. Yeah. Like, I love it when, you know, like in G.I. Joe and, well, fittingly, Cobra Commander and Duke had to work together to, you know, fight against some other, you know, and you always want it to last, you know, whenever you see that in a movie, you're like, oh, maybe they can get along forever.
Yeah. Well, you brought up American culture a few times throughout this, and you could say that, like, again, I don't think that this was premeditated, but I mean, like, especially in the, I don't know a lot about what's going on over there, but I mean, like, red and blue, can they come together somehow and just find common ground and balance instead of just shouting at each other back and forth all the time? And let's do this. No, you're wrong. You're wrong. And it's like, just come together in some way. You don't have to agree on everything, but man, just find common ground and find balance.
For as an American, I can say this, it drives me up the wall because, you know, the Constitution, the opening words of it is "we the people" in order to form a more perfect union. That the idea of unity and balance and being on the same side, even if you're not always getting along, is the founding words of the country. You know, it's like it's meant to be that way. You know, not to get on, you know, my soapbox about politics and stuff, but I think you're absolutely right about that, is that the more messages that media can put out there of unity and cooperation, compared, you know, out of adversity comes, you know, cooperation, the better. You know, if it's coming from Cobra Kai, if it's coming from Stranger Things, if it's coming from the Barbie movie that just came out or was talked about, like, I don't care where it's coming from. That message needs to be driven home all the time, that despite differences, you need to find common ground, because that's the only way that we have a future as any group of people. So, man, I didn't expect to get into that. But
I just thought of that while you were talking. And I'm like, you know what? Rocky ended the Cold War. So why can't Cobra Kai have a huge impact?
He was ahead of his. You know, Sylvester Stallone must have seen that coming. He's like, that Berlin Wall is coming down soon. Yeah, so I better 100%. Get this, you know, because you can be sure that that was on the minds of the people hammering away at the Berlin Wall, was the words of Rocky Balboa after defeating Ivan Drago. I've had so much fun talking to you, Adam, about
this is great.
Cobra Kai. Did you like that picture I sent you last week of
that was funny.
Cobra Kai and I think it was Donatello from Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
It's almost like they, speaking of unity, those two properties, which I think kind of developed independently from each other. Like I said, they both kind of rode that same wave of Eastern culture, Japanese culture arriving into America, but having them, you know, squaring up against each other in toy form was kind of fun.
Yeah, that was funny.
So where can people best find you in podcast world or online?
Yeah, it's Raised on Film, and the two most popular platforms are Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And yeah, I got 12 episodes out, and then also the Viewer's Cut as well. It's still on there. I got a lot of great episodes there with my buddies. They're same platform, Spotify, Apple Podcast, and just a bunch of film nerds talking about film nonsense and stuff we're passionate about.
That's what media is meant for, is to be analyzed. So it's, you know, the more people doing that, the better it gets. So Adam, thank you so much for joining the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source, including Cobra Kai. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Be sure to check out all episodes of the podcast and follow me on social media. Go to everythinghistory.com and click on podcast for more. That's everything-history.com.